the UCR Podcast.
Honoring the legacy of REO Speedwagon, that is the name of the event happening Saturday evening at the State Farm Center in the group's hometown of Champaign, Illinois. Billed as a concert retrospective featuring special guests and former members, the venue is one that has a long history with REO Speedwagon. It first opened as Assembly Hall in 1963, and REO performed there numerous times during the band's long career, and in fact, when they landed there in 1981 during the tour for their smash album High Infidelity, the attendance set a record. It was eventually ranked as one of the top 10 concerts with the highest attendance. Other artists on that list include Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Def Leppard, Fish, The Rolling Stones, U2, and Garth Brooks. Neil Dowdy, Alan Gratzer, and Bruce Hall will add a fresh entry to that list Saturday night. It'll be Alan's first time performing REO songs with his old bandmates in 37 years. They'll be joined by some additional alumni, including vocalists Terry Luttrell and Mike Murphy, guitarist Steve Scorfina, and they'll pay tribute to the late Gary Richrath, as well as the late Greg Philbin, with Gary's son Eric Richrath playing some guitar in honor of his father also. There will be additional special guests, and folks, as you're going to hear during today's discussion, I got to look at the set list. Longtime REO fans are in for a real treat. They're going to be playing the big favorites, but you are also going to hear deep cuts as well, and I mean deep cuts. With all of that in mind, I thought it'd be fun to get Bruce, Alan, and Neil together to talk about what fans can expect at the show, but I also wanted to hear some stories of the early days of REO. We got plenty of those. It was a bit of a chaotic ride in the Speedwagon, but you will hear some fun anecdotes about the band's experiences working with Joe Walsh and Sly Stone, some of the mischief they got into while they were out on the road, and how they evolved as a band and eventually made their biggest record. It's Matt Wardlaw. Thanks again to Alan, Bruce, and Neil for taking some time to look back. The concert, it's happening this Saturday, June 14th, in the group's hometown of Champaign, Illinois. You can get ticket information at statefarmcenter.com. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, make sure to follow it so you'll receive future episodes and enjoy this conversation with Neil Dowdy, Bruce Hall, and Alan Gratzer. Alan, you're the one that has been like away from all this the longest. Like, you know, you mentioned the arrangements. What's been the most interesting one for you to go back to in that regard?
Well, revisiting some of these really early songs, like Only the Strong Survive, and we're doing Sing to Me, which is a very kind of unknown Gary song from the Tuna Fish.
I'm so glad you came up with that, Grass.
I'm glad I thought of it too. It's a song that we never played live ever. But it's a fun song to play. It sounds great. And I think it's going to be a nice surprise for people.
Let's kind of start there. Like, this is such a special show happening June 14th at the State Farm Center, and it's hard to believe that we are barely a week away from everybody hitting the stage. So you've kind of shared a little bit of the science, I think, but let's get into it. Like, how did you guys approach putting the set list together for what fans are going to hear on this night? Because it's an epic task.
It's a lot of work. I mean, it took, you know, we went through a few iterations here to come up with the final product. But once we have it now, I think it's great. There's this early stuff. There's stuff that people really haven't heard live before, a couple songs. But, you know, the early ones that people want to hear are going to be there. And a lot of the people I think that are coming are old diehard Champagne type Midwest people that know the early albums. Know the songs on them.
Back in the old days, Alan always did the set list.
I did.
We take a break and Alan's sitting there going, here's the next set.
What's hilarious is how I used to do it. I had one piece of paper. I put a line down the middle and a line across, so there was four set lists I had to do.
Right.
And my hand, for every, you know, if we were playing a club, we had to play three or four sets, would write down, you know, every song for each one. Trout, I still have some of those somewhere in an old bin someplace. I look at them and go, oh my God, look, here's an old set list from Stevie Lloyd's paper. You know, it's like,
Stevie Lloyd, right?
Yeah.
How did you get tasked with being the guy that did the set list back then?
I don't have any idea.
He's the grown up. He always was.
Yeah, I was always kind of the, you know, grandpa of the band. You know?
Not grandpa.
Well, when I come into the party room at 4 in the morning, guys, we got a plane to catch at, you know, 11 tomorrow morning and a gig tomorrow night. Go to bed. What are you doing? Okay, Grandpa. You know, I got one of those. And you were probably keeping me up because I can't imagine how loud we must have been.
Yeah, I'm sure we were terribly loud because we had guitars and things going. Sure. Yeah.
Dorming in the halls. We had ducks in the bathtub sometime, you know. That one
were
hotel.
Were we supposed to do that kind of stuff? We were supposed to do that.
I know. Expected. It was rock and roll.
Yeah, we went to that hotel that has ducks in the lobby, the Peabody Hotel.
Peabody, right.
And we actually snuck some of those ducks out of the lobby duck pond.
Yeah.
And we had them up in our room.
I know, we did. We had them in the tub.
I mean, like, those ducks are valuable and famous.
Yeah.
And we stole them. But we took them back.
One or two.
We put them back in there.
We were always up to some mischief. Let's put it that way.
I know.
That's what rock and roll bands do, though. That's what you're supposed to do.
Absolutely. We were banned from the Hiltons for a year. I remember that. So that was good.
Oh, that's right.
We stormed the front desk with sheets around us. It was like a toga party. We were pretending to have a toga party and went down and went to the front desk. And somebody actually leaped over the desk and got back there. And I think
England.
Was it Mike Anglin? Yeah.
Hey, Mikey.
Yeah. That might have been what put us over the top to get banned.
Yep.
Alan, you kind of like mentioned a couple of songs, but, you know, Neil and Bruce, to let you put your piece into it, like, were there certain things that you two really lobbied for? Because that's really kind of, to me, what it makes me think of, this is probably one of the only times that we're going to reference Taylor Swift and REO Speedwagon in the same sentence, but obviously Taylor Swift did her Eras tour, where it's like she got to, as the name would suggest, touch on all the eras of her career. And even though she is still, you know, in her 30s at this point, she's been through a lot of eras as an artist. And so similarly, there are a lot of different eras of REO Speedwagon. And I think that's what's great about this show, is that with the personnel that you guys have involved, you know, Terry Luttrell, Mike Murphy, Steve Scorfina, like, I mean, these are just incredible names. Like, so just the lineup of players that are playing with you guys kind of dictates that, like, we can really, like, have some fun here. So, like, it must have been, you know, as, like I said, as Alan kind of laid out, like, you guys must have had some fun kind of crawling your memory banks going, oh man, now maybe we could play this one. So what were some of the things that you really felt strongly about that, like, you wanted to kind of put forth?
Go ahead, you guys, you're up.
Well, Terry's got a band. Luttrell has a band that's going to open up.
Sure.
First. And he's doing some of the stuff off the first album, actually. I think
here's
that's
exactly what he's doing, if you can read that. The top son of a poor man, gypsy woman's passion, anti-establishment man in Golden Country. And three of those songs are from our very first album in 1971. So Son of a Poor Man came later, but he wanted to do Golden Country. We had Golden Country done first. Now he's doing that last. And he's starting with Son of a Poor Man, which I think would be a more upbeat,
nice.
You know, rocking.
That's a good move.
Song, yeah. And then end with Golden Country. And I think the Scorpion is going to come out for Gypsy Woman's Passion, the second song.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
I've seen Steve for a long time.
Yeah, no, it'll be fun. In fact, Steve touched base on Instagram the other day. It was him and Ricky, and Steve was there, and they were in a record store, I think in St. Louis or something, signing, an old REO poster. It was old, and had Cheap Trick way down there in really teeny prints. I was surprised that Rick signed it, because I would have been a little PO. Anyway.
Yeah, Neil and I just saw them recently.
Yeah, they're the same Cheap Trick. I mean, Ricky and Robin, we hung out with them down in Tampa.
Oh, nice.
Not long ago.
Yeah, cool.
And once again, I thanked them because my wife married me because I know Cheap Trick.
Oh no!
And I'm not. I mean,
which he did seem to like.
Think I'm kidding, but now we've been together 20 years, and so every now and then we go to a Cheap Trick concert, and I go, by the way, did I ever thank you guys for this lovely girl that married me because I know you guys? So Cheap Trick's done a lot for me. You know.
There you go.
They sound great. They sound
yeah.
They're the real thing. Yeah.
Rick's son is playing drums.
Ben left.
Yeah, I know that.
And I've seen him since then, and he seems to feel like everybody got treated okay.
Yeah.
And it's Ricky's son that's playing.
Yeah, Rick's.
Yeah, right? I thought it was
and
Rick's
he's son. Really good.
Neil, I should probably know this story, but how did you get the nickname Trout? I think fans, if they aren't familiar, would love to know that.
Trout will tell you. I know.
Yeah, that's one reason this thing in Champaign, because I'm going to see Terry Luttrell and, you know, maybe beat him up or something, because he's the one that gave me that nickname. And it wasn't for that good of a reason either. Captain Beefheart, the famous
Trout Mask Replica.
I don't know if anybody
Trout Mask Replica. That was
the
album.
Way back in the day. He had album called Trout Mask Replica with a giant trout mask on the cover. And I became obsessed with what a great cover and title that was.
Yeah,
you heard about Captain Beefheart. He's got Trout Mask Replica. Luttrell got fed up with it. And he says, if you don't shut up about this, I'm going to start calling you Trout. And he did. And 55 years later, people are still calling me Trout.
What? I think it's a great nickname. I like it. Fit.
I'm not sure if it seems to be.
Well,
you know, buff for a while too.
Yeah, you were buff.
It's only certain people that are allowed to do that. And two of them are here right now. So,
where did buff come from? How did buff?
Buff was when Bill Fiorio wanted to change the name of the band to Buffalo Dowdy and the Blue Jays.
Oh boy,
that was typical Bill Fiorio.
Well, he changes it to Duke Tomato. So
he's Tomato, right?
Yeah. Now the only person that still calls me Buff is Mary Lou Hamill.
Oh no,
she calls me Buff to this day. Nice. So she's the only one allowed to do that.
Yeah, I forgot about that one totally.
Yeah, that's when I first met Neil. He was called Buff.
Well, let's talk for a moment about two people who are going to be honored during this show that are no longer with us. And it's obviously a big thrill that I'll start with Rich Rath, because it's a big thrill that Eric Rich Rath is going to be there on behalf of his dad. Can each of you three perhaps share a Gary memory? Because for a lot of fans, as you know, like, he's a big part of the heart of REO Speedwagon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like what a rock star that guy was. And this one song that Alan put on the set list, Sing to Me, which we'd never played live. I'm you know, playing along with the record here, I'm going, man, Rich Rath.
Yeah.
I killed on that song. I mean, going through this, it's kind of bittersweet. Like, man, that guy was some guitar player. Gosh.
Yeah, I know. Well, for me, I haven't listened to these REO songs this intensely for years and years, and realizing now in retrospect how incredible of a guitar player he was. I mean, he's great. I mean, sometimes maybe not live as much, but I think all of the recorded stuff that he ended up doing,
he had this kind of a sloppy style that was okay. He had what I think you call swagger. He was kind of like, He had a great showman too. He was up front, played great guitar. Chuck.
No, I miss him every day. It's just hard.
There was a time when Gary was caught in a fire in Champaign. You know this story.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And he got out and he went down the awning and he was on the ground and there was a fire. And the reporters came and interviewed him. And then they called him Charles Kitchrath.
I think Charles Kitchrath. Yeah, we were calling her Charles for quite a while,
for the longest time, and then it became Chuck. I called Chuck. But when I first met Gary, he came from Peoria, and he joined my band in Champaign. That's how I got to Champaign. Yeah. It was a band called Feather Train, and he wasn't yet what he was with you guys, not with REO, but he was working on it.
Yeah, no, he was definitely a rock star, the stud of the band, basically, and. It was always fun to watch from behind.
Yeah, the only problem was on albums, he would sometimes put 8 tracks of rhythm guitar.
Yeah.
Literally. Like 8 guys. 8 Gary Richraths playing rhythm at the same time. And sometimes there was like no room in the sonic spectrum for keyboards by the time he got done. That's why you hear like these tinkly little high piano sounds and stuff on some of the songs. There was no place else to put it. But one of the things I've been doing with these songs is some of the keyboard parts that were just kind of a synth pad and buried in the mix. And as they would say, well, it you would miss it if it weren't there.
Yeah.
Don't worry about the fact you can't hear it at all.
Yeah, right.
It's an illusion. So with only one guitar going on rhythm, or maybe two, you know, but I've playing more on the at this show, I'll be playing more on these songs.
Oh, great.
Than
great.
I did, because I over the years I've really that my favorite instrument is the Hammond B3 organ, and they've got one for me. They found a vintage one for me in Champaign. And I've just learned to play nice little stuff on the organ, and you hear it, but it doesn't get in the way of anything as long as I'm doing.
Trout, you're a keyboard genius. You really are. I mean, I think you play piano like nobody else. I mean, the way you play those.
I'm more of a physics genius, actually. But
you wish. Professor Krovskin.
Alan and I were engineering students at the University of Illinois.
Well, Trout, let's
leave that.
Not really. And I changed majors every single semester. I went to school for 2.5 years, 5 semesters, and I changed. I had a new one every year, and I also got called at the end of every year. Got called into the, who's the guy that is in charge of curriculum and whatever.
The dean, right?
You're going to have to do something to bring these grades up, or else I'm afraid you won't be able to attend the university. Ooh. So I just tell everybody, I got called into the dean's office all the time, so he could tell me how great I was. But we get home at 1 or 2 in the morning, and I'd have an 8 o'clock class. And Gardner, which I never could make, so it was insane.
I was trying to try high school. Jesus.
I would walk into class, the only guy with long hair, I had maybe or maybe not, allegedly, had smoked some pot.
Yeah.
And then there's math from another universe on all 4 walls of the classroom. One day I just looked at it all and got sick and just walked out, never came back. And that's when I told the guy, I got to change my major to something. Yeah. And somehow I was on academic probation the entire time I was there. I don't know how. I mean, they finally just asked me to not come back. But how I clung to staying in school without ever going to class and like talking to people. But professor, there's a war going on, and if I flunk out, they'll draft me, and a lot of them were quite sympathetic about that too, because that was at the time the war was winding down, and we knew we couldn't win, and we actually wanted to bring the soldiers home. That all those anti-war protests. I mean, I have a very close friend just saw at a high school reunion. And he was over there. He was in the jungle, and he had artillery landing next to him. I said, how'd you feel about us hippies over there, protesting the war? And he goes, well, we didn't like it. And I said, but we weren't anti-soldier. We wanted to get you guys home. Because even Walter Cronkite, became outspoken that, look, the Pentagon's own study said the war is lost.
Yeah.
We have to bring people home before more people get killed, for a lost cause. And that's what we're protesting. So I don't want, anybody that watches this was that was over there and upset by I have felt bad about that, almost my whole life, and, try to give money to the, wounded warriors and stuff like that.
We get up for our trial. We played for the troops. We tried. Played in places, trying to bring them.
Yes, we did. Oh, yeah. I mean, we were over in Germany all the time playing for U.S. soldiers.
Yeah, they loved us actually when we went to Germany and played. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that was a weird.
It was intense.
for all of us. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was very being on academic probation and knowing if you flunk out, you're going straight to that jungle and people will be trying to kill you. Yeah. And so that put a little bit of pressure, you know, on the final exams, especially when you hadn't been to class at all.
No, it was tough. And I had to take two physicals. I went the first physical. I, you know, went from 140 to 114 pounds.
Whoa.
They looked at me and my hair was down the middle of my back. And they went, well, no, you're underweight. But we get to call you back in 6 months if because, you know, weight fluctuates. You know, and I remember coming back to Chances Are after that because I had starved myself for a few days. Back came back to Chances Are. I got two of those giant, really great burgers they used to have.
Oh, yeah.
And I ate them and immediately puked because I ate them.
I mean, like, allegedly.
Running into the bathroom and throwing up because it was like.
Oh, yeah.
But and then later I finally had to, you know, and Irving Azoff and John had this method for all the Blytham people. There's like 25 bands or whatever. And they, you know, you're going to get called in probably at some point. If you got to go in and take the physical, here's what you do. And they prepped everybody on just don't answer any questions. Just go say, I need to see a psychiatrist. And they'll go, oh, yes, okay, you're allowed to do that. And you go in and you tell them you're gay, which the second time is what I did. You know, and here's the questions they're going to ask you. What's cruising? You know, what's some other terms like that? And I said them, and they just went, okay, you're out of here. And so
get out of here.
Thank God for that, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
I want to talk to you guys about Greg Philbin. And, you know, Bruce, you mentioned high school. So you've spent a lot of years with some of those parts that Greg originally laid down prior to your arrival. And, you know, you're a fellow Champaign guy, obviously, who spent time at Centennial High School. So in a word, I think it's very apparent to anybody listening to this that, like, you've been in the REO universe for a long time before you actually come into REO. When you came into REO, what did you appreciate about Greg's approach to the instrument?
There are a lot of bands in Champaign at the time, and everybody, of course, had a bass player. Greg was different. He played, it wasn't like John Entwistle so much. It was unique. It was, I think he came up, helped you guys with the arrangements in the early days.
Over-arranging.
Also, I think things are great. He had a really kind of fluid kind of, it wasn't funk, but it wasn't just runaway stuff. I loved it. I used to watch him play, and I go, Jesus Christ, this guy, he's a monster.
Yeah. Well, we're doing Lost in a Dream. And if you listen to Greg's bass part in Lost in a Dream, it is, I mean, now I didn't appreciate it at the time, but now after hearing it, you know, 100 times in the last 2 or 3 months, I'm going, oh my God. I mean, he sounds like Jack Bruce on an incredible day. Very, not repeating stuff. I mean, I think the difference between Greg, I thought was lost a lot of times, but he's actually, you know, listening to that, he kind of knew where he was going, but he wasn't great as, like, you were a great rhythm bass player, Bruce, and obviously still are, but, and Greg would be kind of flaming all over the place, playing a little bit of lead bass, like Jack Bruce, or like you said, John, that was the same thing.
Yeah. I tell you what, I loved it. He did, when you guys did Lost in a Dream and he did all that bass work, I wrote that song with Mike Murphy, and it was I think it's Greg's little thing going, okay, motherfucker, here you go. Here's a bass part for you.
Listen to that. Was great. Yeah. No, the you bass part, pretty amazing.
The bass that I play right now that I call Butter, she's my favorite bass I've had for years, I bought from Greg years ago.
Wow.
Remember.
Yeah. And she's going to be with me on this last show.
Nice.
I've been interested listening to these Mike Murphy albums and looking at the Riding the Storm Out record in particular. How did it end up that, what was the experience you guys, you know, Neil and Alan, of course, playing with Joe Walsh on a few of the songs?
I don't know if we overdubbed Joe. It's like Sly Stone came in and played on one of the Murphy albums too. And Sly came in at 10 at night, poured out a pile
of course.
A foot high, and, you know, put on a rhythm part, and then he put on a bass part, and then about midnight or 1 in the morning, he looks at me and goes, mind if I call my drummer? I said, yeah, I think I do mind if you call your drummer. It's getting late. Right. But yeah, but with Walsh, I can't remember. What did Walsh?
You know what? You know what? During the Murphy years, we toured with Walsh's old band, Barnstorm, a lot. And we asked him to come put, somebody said, can you come put a slide part here and there on the album we're working on? And he did. Yeah. We were friends with him at the time.
You guys mentioned Sly Stone, so we got to hear the story. How does Sly Stone end up on an REO record?
We were at the record plant in Sausalito. We made, what was it? Well, it was one of the Murphy albums, like the second or third one. And we were just there, you know, working away. And all of a sudden, in through the door, he comes in, you know, plops, like I said, that pile on the console. And just, hey, Cats sound great. He said, mind if I, you know, put a little something on this, you know? And, you know, we said, oh, great. This will be great because we can, you know, advertise it on the back of the album. I looked at the back of the album. It's in the dinkiest print I've ever seen in my life. I mean, wait a minute. Why didn't we push this more at the time? But he was in, you know, obviously he started out. I watched his documentary on Netflix or whatever it was on, you know, a couple of months ago. And he started out a musical genius. I mean, right. Amazing. Wrote all those great songs, played a lot of the instruments, and was incredible. And then once he started, you know, snorting and doing whatever he wanted to do, did way too many drugs, man, his creativity went right down the tubes. And, you know, remember you showed up, Trout, at, when we were doing a demo in Hollywood, doing the demos for High Infidelity, and somebody knocks on the door, and a door's locked, there's a peephole, and the guy that owned that little studio said, Sly's at the door, and he's holding a gun. You know, we all went, should I let him in? No, don't let him in. Were you nuts? So that's what he devolved to. I mean, he was just on the streets, you know, cruising around, trying to still go into studios, whatever. But, you know, I mean, that poor guy, it's too bad. He's totally sober now. When you see the end of the documentary, he's like an old grandfather and he's got grandkids and his kids around. His kids have reunited with him. So it has a happy end. But, man, what he went through the ringer.
Yeah, I guess most of us kind of slow down on that stuff eventually. I haven't stopped completely, but now it's at a legitimate occasion. I don't sit at home by myself and drink things. You
know? Yeah. I have my one glass of wine a week. That's it.
In fact, I just had the best physical checkup of my life.
Nice.
What about your mental?
And I think it's because I left the road. It's been a really, really, really long time since I abused alcohol and drugs, like really long time ago.
And Neil, but, you were having trouble sleeping on the bus. That became a problem for you.
Sleep
on the bus.
Yeah.
You're on the bus all the time.
My shrink gave me pills for sleeping on the bus. On the bottle, it says, caution, these may make you drowsy the next day. And I said, you know what else makes you drowsy the next day? Lying awake all night on the damn bus.
Really. I hated sleeping on the bus. And only luckily for me, I only had to do it, I don't know what, 3, maybe 4 years. And I just hated it. You do fall asleep finally on the bus. And then you got to wake up at 8 o'clock as you're at the hotel, try to wake up and then go back to sleep in a hotel room. It was like,
Well, we made it so that you don't have to do that. I mean, if you don't feel like it. Because there's nothing, you're right, Gratz. There's nothing worse than getting up, going
so
in.
So you didn't stay on the bus and sleep, I assume. Yeah. I never did that. Should have.
My body clock is still on road time, even though I left the road.
Yeah, mine too.
2.5 years ago. I really don't get moving till like 4 p.m. And, you know, and then I'm fine. I wake up going, oh my God. That.
We got to get to rehearsing.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, rehearsing, by the way, at that studio, we have it from 10 to 5. So
you should use it. I'll be there at 4.
Okay.
I was going to say, I think you just need about an hour. That sounds about right, Dale. Yeah.
Because I'm a musical genius.
There you go.
And when you're a physics guy that also plays keyboards, you got this, Dale. Yep. I know you do.
I can't believe you went home to your parents and said, I'm going to quit school and join a band. I'm going to be in a rock band. With Nestor Lefty Grove?
No, my dad wrote me a six-page letter. You're making the biggest mistake of your life. What are you doing?
Right.
They hated it until the first time they saw the band.
Oh, yeah.
Which was down at SIU at that big festival. They would throw it on there. By then, we were pretty well-known in the St. Louis area because they were sneaking all of our albums out of miscellaneous R and putting them in front of Stack. Yeah, so I think my parents might have made us famous in St. Louis.
They were cute. I like Bob and Daddy. They were great.
Clearly, it has been an interesting process for you guys going through all the different eras of REO Speedwagon's music. And fans have obviously, as you all will be aware of, talked about the group's transition from what they view as the harder rock version of REO in the 70s into the more commercial version. And I think a lot of people plot High Infidelity as that transitional moment. But there were 8 albums leading up to that. If we look at everything that led up to High Infidelity, what sticks out to you guys now looking at the path that this band took? Because it's a really interesting path of evolution.
I think we grew up a little bit. I just think, you know, when you start a band in your early 20s, and then by that time you've been married, you've got kids, you know, your priorities change a little bit. And, you know, I just thought, you know what? We've been trying to play as hard and loud and as fast as we can all the time and thought that was really cool. And, you know, and it still is. It's still there. And we're going to do some of it next Saturday. But then, you know, I think we just all realized that, you know what, we can slow down a little bit and see what happens. And luckily, you know, Kevin wrote Keep on Loving You. So, you know, and before that, he wrote Time for Me to Fly even.
Yeah,
you know?
So, that's right.
So that was a kind of a precursor of, I think, what the second half of our career became. And, you know, if you listen to something like Good Trouble, we were rocking out on that album pretty good too. Even on High Fidelity, those demos were, you know, not well, you know, we just kind of played freely, everybody in the studio, and 7 of those tracks are the demo track.
I think we tried to get, there was a time when I think Gary and Kevin tried to start writing sort of hits for the radio. I mean, they were trying to get it because the albums would only get up so far and then they start coming back down. And there was no singles to help them promote hires.
You know, and High Infidelity was when Gary and Kevin had always kind of been wanting to go in 2 different directions. High Infidelity is when it worked together. Because when Keep on Loving You, when Kevin first brought that in on piano, I didn't like it. I thought it was a little too
very mellow.
But then Gary starts putting power chords on it. Yeah. And, you know, Kevin was always a little acoustic and Gary was always a little bit shred. And on that album, those 2 things finally worked together instead of pulling each other apart. And we've been accused of selling out because we got a ballad on the radio, but you know, we did a ballad just thinking, you know, well, this record's going to be like every other one.
Yeah.
We grew up and then go play basketball. That's what we did. Yeah. We played a lot of basketball.
We did.
Yes, we did.
But the live shows were always mostly up-tempo. I always say, you know, when the tempo slows down, that doesn't mean the energy level does. I mean, when you're at a speed where the whole crowd can sing along, that ups the energy, if anything. So, you know, hearing people sing along with Keep on Loving You and Can't Fight This Feeling, it's a huge energy.
There's something Gratzer did that I never played with a drummer like that. It was as the song would progress, it would start to speed up a little bit. But I thought that was cool. And by
I listen to it now, and there are some songs that I put my AirPods in. Okay, I'm going to play along, and then I go, wait a minute, it's starting to speed up here, and this is on the record. You know, I'm going, I can't listen to it anymore. I've got to just play it and remember the arrangement.
Yeah,
I'm not doing that anymore.
Gave it
too old to speed up.
Yeah.
Well, you listen. you listen to any band and the records they made in the 70s, some of those rhythm tracks were all over the place.
Oh, I know. I know. 20th Century Fox that I'm going to see.
Oh, baby. But that's right. It
actually speeds up too, because I play them along with that and I'm going, wait a minute. I'm not going to play it like this. I'm gonna keep
Wait,
it
are you going to sing that and play drums at the same time?
Yes, I am. Well, unless you want to play drums, I'll go up front.
Does that sure. Be I'll give it a try.
You're not going to
I
it.
Did play drums on about four songs.
Yeah, you did. Try to go. I go out and play bass.
This, yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
This is bass. The early days for the four old four-piece band that started in the dorm. We were like all switching instruments around every few songs.
I played bass on at least four songs, more than that. I thought I was doing Purple Haze.
Yeah, Purple Haze, all right.
I did Sunshine of Your Love.
Hey, that's a good one.
Yeah, I was playing drums on that. Just beating toms all through the whole thing.
Accenting one and three. I know that was good.
Well, Grass, I can't wait to hear you sing 20th Century Fox.
Oh, it's gonna be fine. It's actually fun to sing. It's in my range, and so I don't have to worry about that.
Hey, it worked for Don Henley and Phil Collins. You know, I think you can pull it off.
What does it mean to you guys to have Steve Scorfina, Mike Murphy, and, you know, Terry Luttrell back into the mix for this show at the State Farm Center?
I think it's going to be interesting and fun. You know, I mean, just seeing the guys. I mean, Steve Scorfina, I haven't seen him for, God, 40 years, it seems like. And when I see him online, I go, oh, God, it's Steve. But, you know, he looks totally different than he did when he was back in REO days. But, I think it's going to be fun. Murph, you know, we've all aged. You know, it's part of life.
The different members of the band are our version of the Eras tour.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, Murphy was in a band with me before he left to go join REO Speedwagon. We had a band called One Eye Jacks. I at first didn't see how it was going to work with Murph in REO.
Yeah.
It was
a different era.
Man.
More R&B, a little more R&B kind of funk going. But I mean, it's funny listening to Lost in a Dream, the two guitars, and I really wish that Murph would play that guitar part, but he said he hasn't picked up a guitar in decades. So
he had the accident. He had that accident.
Yeah, so I just, you know, let it go. But man, his guitar solo was actually very cool, very clean, very nicely done. And then the second half is Gary's, you know, a much beefier Marshall sound. And so the contrast between the two is just to me.
Well, Murph learned to play guitar by listening to B.B. King. He was the B.B. King.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yeah.
B.B. only knows two licks, though. So
that's about it.
Hey, that's all you got to know.
There you get it.
It's rock and roll, man.
There's hit singles that had one chord.
Reelin', that was a good song. Reelin' was a great song.
I remember Reelin'.
River of Life, I like that song.
Yeah.
That's. I think I used to play that with him.
Did you?
River of Life.
River of Life. Yeah. I've been just concentrating on the songs, to be honest, that we're going to do in the set list. Yeah. And here, you want to take a quick picture, man, of the whole thing. You'll know. I can actually email you a set list if you want to know before.
I just would love to see it as a fan. Like, I'd love to keep it as a surprise for the fans themselves, but I would be interested in seeing that because just the couple of times that you flashed it at me, like I'll do a quick moment of show and tell that, like, kind of illustrates, you know, what you guys have been through as a band. I've got these two CD box sets that if I was, looking at these on vinyl, this would probably be, like, you know, obviously a sizable stack of LP records. So I am grateful that it's a little bit more compact, but, like, it's been a long journey. And I know for me as a fan, and I hear talking to you guys, that it has been equally the same thing for you. But, like, just as an example today, like, as I listened to those first two REO albums, you know, hearing things like Flashed Hand Queen from REO 2 and, you know, Dead at Last from the first REO record, like, the band had this really cool progressive rock thing happening that you kind of move away from. But even if you listen to, like, the Lost in a Dream record, if you hear the way, like, You Can Fly segues out of Sky Blues on that record, like, you still had kind of, like, those progressive moments there occasionally. So it's really intriguing. All the, and I think that as you guys have kind of spoken to as we've been talking, it's just the evolution of a band, but it's just really interesting. And you talked, you know, Alan, you talked about 20th Century Fox. Like, obviously, like, so much of what you become as a band is influenced by the songs that you're playing in a cover band or whatever before right. you have your actual proper band. But it's like, it's been the whole REO thing over the years has been a really interesting rock and roll stew, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's funny because when Neil and I, after we finished our first year of school, he went back to St. Louis, Belleville. I went back to Arlington Heights in Chicago. And we just told each other, okay, learn the first Doors album. We'll start there. And Neil came back, played Light My Fire, the 6-minute solo in the middle, note for note. You know, and I'm going, oh my God, we do it better than the Doors do live. Because I saw the Doors live on TV once, and I thought, wait a minute, they're not even trying. But yeah.
That intro, man.
We're a good
that
cover
was
band.
Hard.
Yeah, that was very cool.
Self-taught too, Neil Dowdy. You just picked up a keyboard and started learning how to play it.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we're all self-taught.
But
actually,
I had played piano like Beatles songs in high school.
Yeah,
I taught myself to play with Beatles songs and old beat up piano in the basement. And then when I used to follow Alan's first band on campus around.
Yeah.
What was
that? The Barbarians or the Potomai?
That was the Potomai.
The Barbarians of Rick Thady. Rick Thady's Barbarians.
Yeah. Oh, Rick Thady.
I mean, but they didn't like their keyboard player. And I said, I can play keyboards, which was a lie. I mean, I'm sort of a exaggeration.
Oh. He was like the leader of the band, though, that dude. I forgot his name.
Yeah.
But, anyway.
Paul Gula.
Oh, Paul Gula. God, I forgot. Yeah. Holy moly. He was a pain. But that guy,
you have to understand, there was a with Blytham and everything around that town of Champaign, there was a lot of musicians and there was a lot of places to play.
Yeah.
So that's really how come there were so many bands and we all got a chance to like get better is because we could play a lot.
Yeah. I mean, we played 7 nights a week.
Yeah.
7 different places. You know, it was crazy.
That was Bob Nutt and Blytham, those guys.
Yeah. Nutso and Irving and John. Tamley was gone.
Yeah, our first manager was Irving Azoff, who has sort of made a name for himself.
You think so?
I talked to him the other day. We're going, hey, I kind of miss you sometimes, buddy. You know, so he's always been nice to us, even though some people, I think people are jealous of him because he's like the most successful music executive that ever lived. And, there's a little bit of envy involved when
he still
people
calls me Brucey.
Huh?
Every time I see Irving, he calls me Brucey. He calls me Brucey.
Brucey? Yeah. No, he still calls me Sticks. Hey, Sticks. That was his nickname for me. Yeah, it's funny. And I think, after I'm done here, I'm going to text John and have him. I think he's already been in touch with Irving about coming to Champaign. I doubt if Irving would come, but it'd be kind of interesting. If
never know.
It'd be awesome, though.
Yeah, it would be hilarious.
Yeah, you may
like some of those pictures on the quad where he's leaning on the speakers, you know, listening to us, you know, while we're playing in the quad. Irving's about 4 feet tall.
That was a big time if you hit the quad. Gosh, if you could play on the quad.
Well, those Vietnam, Indians, whatever, were on the quad. I remember being at the front of the line, leading a hippie string of people all the way through the student union and out the other door, or out the side back. I turned around and looked. How did I get in front? I mean, I'm not that big of a promoter here, but anyway, it was pretty funny.
You guys, we could go and swap stories for another few hours, but you've been very great with your time. And I just really, this is exactly why I wanted to get you guys together, was because I think this is a very special thing that is happening both for you guys and for the fans. And I love the fact that it is going to go to, you know, benefit, you know, charity. Like, everything about this thing is, you know, good. And I'll speak from the fan perspective that, like, I'm glad that you guys get an opportunity to do this. And as we have heard from all these stories that you guys have shared, this obviously means a lot to you. So it's like, congrats, because this is going to be a really good night for you guys.
It'll be great to see each other. As you can tell, I don't see Alan very much.
No. So,
I see Bruce more.
Yeah.
Because we go on about 10 Disney cruises a year.
Yeah,
hey, when you get them for free, what do you want? You might as well do it.
You know what I'm going to love about this show is the fact that we get, I think it kind of, we have closure and we get to say goodbye to the fans and tell them thank you for all the years of.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I think you're right. It's going to be a great celebration. I kind of,
it's going to be great.
At this point, I had to be talked into it for about a week.
I know.
But then now that I'm in 100%, so it's going to be
great. I can great tell.
I can't wait. Yeah. Yeah, well, we're going to do good.
We're going to do great. We are. We're going to do great.
It'll be great to see each other, too.
Yeah, no. Yeah, just to play again. I'm excited about that. It's been 37 freaking years for me.
I know. So, I can't wait to play with Gratz again. We Locke. I love playing.
I know. It's going to be great fun. Can't wait. I know.
All right, boys. Well, thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you, Matt.
How many questions
are there, Matt?
Three. I think he maybe asked three questions, and the rest of it was just us rambling.
I know. We never let the poor guy talk on the show. But
for the record, I asked at least four questions, and they were all – I was thrilled to ask all of them. But no, seriously, guys, this was a lot of fun. I think you guys got to share some stories that fans are going to really appreciate. And, you know, here's to the show. Have a great night, y'all. Yeah.
Thank you.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.